Hey there, this is your old buddy Tom, the Toonami Operations Module. Settle in, it's about to get good. Toonami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Whenever you're ready.
Welcome to the televised revolution, as we drift through outer space aboard the Absolution. With Tom back in active duty as captain, in charge of bringing superior anime action. Yeah, you came to the right place if you have a taste for animation in deep space base. Broadcast through your television due to the progress of the Bring Back Toonami Twitter mission. The same block that brought us Sailor Moon and Dragon Ball Z is back, so stay tuned. I remember way back, never leaving my room. I stayed glued to my TV weekday afternoons. Yeah, and thanks to Adult Swim, I have a reason to use the TV in my room again. Cause every night I'll be tuning in, since they going back to showing action tunes again. Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Yeah, Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Welcome to the anime action fan sanctuary, with Tom providing that slick commentary.
Hey there, my Toonami generation, and welcome to a brand new episode of Tom's Prerogative, right here on the Absolution Network. I'm, of course, your primetime host, Thomas. Primetime Mattis, and I welcome you to episode 79 of The Prerogative. Well, we are now in December, ladies and gentlemen. That fun time of year when the snow blankets the earth, and snowballs abound, sledding abound, and of course all the wonderful Christmas movies that we quote forever and ever, like, you know, classic lines, like, Shitter's full! I don't know, that's a classic line to me. I don't know what constitutes to you as a classic line. But, you know, of course December means, like I said, wintry movies. So, I've set out to review this month, you know, winter and, you know, Christmas-like movies. Which was a lot harder than it might sound. But as I'm searching through all the things, I'm like, oh, I'm definitely going to review that, but I don't know if I should start off with that, and I can review that, but I don't know if I should start off with that, so what can I start off December with that is not quite Christmassy, but wintry? I can't review Frozen, because I want to wait for the DVD, and that will be Disney Month. Not that it has to be in Disney Month, but I kind of want it there. I want to watch the DVD, I want to watch it a couple times. Because like I said, when I did that sort of spoiler-free review last episode, that was just off the top of my head from one viewing. Maybe I'll come to like the music a little bit more in a second viewing. Those things are very possible to happen. But again, that brings us to our current dilemma. What the hell do I start off December with? And then I looked at my DVD shelf, and you know, I have, you know, Spider-Man movies, I have The Black Mask, I have Boondocks, I have Beast Wars, just an anime, a lot of different movies, you know, Little Mermaid, which reminds me that I need to get the new Blu-ray release of it. There's a Returner, a Japanese action film, not important here. Stripperella, I've already reviewed that. The Superman Doomsday, already reviewed that. Aladdin already. Wait a minute, what's this thing in the P section? I know I didn't go in order. Just level with me here. But this thing in the P section? It's a movie that kind of very near and dear my heart. I've always had an enjoyable time watching it. I remember loving it as a kid. I see it for its flaws now as an adult, but a movie I've always known to enjoy. I'm like, wait a minute, this is a wintry movie. Somewhat connects to Christmas at the end. And also features the music from, according to my best friend, is maybe my mother's favorite musician, because we're Jewish and he's Jewish. And So that, of course, means we love him. That being Barry Manilow. If you haven't guessed already from the clues I gave you, this week we will be reviewing Pebble and the Penguin. The Don Bluth animated feature, which I think this actually makes it my first Don Bluth animated film I'm reviewing. You would think I would want to first review Secret of Nim, a good Don Bluth film, but we'll get to that at some point. But yeah, this is my first Don Bluth film as part of MGM Entertainment as they try to snip off a piece of the epic crowd that was Disney. For those you youngins that may be listening, like very young people listening to this podcast, but you know, who may not know, in the people say late 80s, it was really a Who Framed Roger Rabbit and Little Mermaid, though Great Mouse Detective and Oliver was. They were good movies. They weren't. We're talking about movies like this is a Little Mermaid here. So it's really early 90s. Disney was just a tad bit big at that point. And everybody wanted a piece of that pie because it was Disney who let everybody know, holy crap. You know, this animated thing could make us some money. We need to get in on this. So, you know, MGM went to, hey, Don! Yeah, Don in Ireland! Don Bluth, come here! Come here! Can you make us a children's movie that's more for children to try to suck the money out of parents' pockets? Okay! And so we have Pebble and the Penguin. Now, mind you, I say that knowing full well that Don Bluth did his absolutely best, and him and his production company. Yeah. And then, you know, for the most part, you know, as we'll get into the review, this is a flawed movie. I'm not going to pretend anything about that. I think this movie gets a completely bad rap that is not warranted. I mean, we're going to get into the review and everything, but a lot of people are going to point out that it's very formulaic and it's copying the Disney formula, and no doubt it is. That doesn't mean it's bad, though. You know, for the longest time, people have been copying. You know, Star Wars copies formula of other movies and television. You know, and by the way, that's another reason why my mind went to review Pebble and the Penguin this week. You know, because I was thinking, you know, Frozen is a movie where my issue is I kind of feel it's a bit too Broadway. Well, Pebble the Penguin is a bit too Broadway. So there's a connection here between Frozen and Pebble and the Penguin, as far as I'm concerned, in the sense of both these movies are a bit too Broadway. Now, while, in all honesty, in subsequent viewings of Frozen, my mind can change on Frozen, whether it's good or bad, at this point in time, you know, again, it is, they're both a bit too Broadway. I mean, literally, it's too broad. We'll get into it when we get character designs and music and everything. You can literally see it being a stage show, which is very appropriate for it being a cartoon. This is Don Bluth. I've always, to an extent, considered Don Bluth's work cartoons, not anime, as opposed to the Disney stuff that came out in the 90s, because it is the perfect example of what the difference between a cartoon and anime is. Again, we'll get to all this when we get to the review itself. But yeah, we're gonna go into it because there are some things that I think are really good about this movie. There are things that are bad about this movie. But we'll get into all that and more, like I said, in the review. Which, you know, consider I keep saying we're gonna get to it in the review, maybe we should get to the review. So let's go over our synopsis. Our story follows Hubie, a shy, gullible, but kind-hearted penguin who is in love with the beautiful and kind Marina, but lacks the self-confidence, leading him to be bullied by a much more aggressive but vain and cruel Drake, who also wants Marina, but, you know, clearly, because, you know, she's the most beautiful penguin in the land, and, you know, he's the best penguin in the land, and that makes me the best. So don't I deserve the best? When I first saw her, I could hardly... Oh, I'm sorry, I'm mixing up my movies. One night, QB and Marina managed to confirm how they feel for each other, but QB can't quite find the perfect pebble to propose to Marina for. He wishes on the star to make his dreams come true and receives a kryptonite emerald from the sky that then gives him radiation poison and he dies. No. Ecstatic, QB rushes to find Marina so he can give her the obviously radioactive stone that will kill her in 2 months. But it's stopped by Drake, who demands QB to give him the Allspark, the stone. But QB refuses, so Drake throws him in the water where a leopard seal is lurking. QB narrowly escapes the leopard seal and climbs onto a piece of ice where he's swept away from the Antarctic. He soon finds himself on a boat named Misery with other penguins. There he finds a rebel without a cause, Rocco the Rock Hopper penguin named Rocco. Why is he a rebel? Because he came here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And it's all out of bubblegum. Thank you for the 5 of you who get the Roddy Piper reference. After managing to escape the good ship Misery, Rocco and Huey embark on a journey back to the Antarctic, where Huey will save his love Marina from the cruel Drake. This is A Pebble and the Penguin. Talking about the musical pieces here. You know what? A lot of people are going to make fun of this. It's Barry Manilow. Copa, Copa Cabana. They called him Colt. Colt Cabana. CM Punk said your name in a pipe bomb rolled in WWE. And now your fame. I'm sorry, what was I talking about? It all comes back to wrestling. I never should have done that Roddy Piper bit. Now I am going to make wrestling jokes all day long. But that's here nor there. Barry Manilow does the music. And a lot of people knock it because it's Barry Manilow. I don't like the guy either, but that doesn't mean it's bad. But I think most people are going to knock it for the music being generic. And I don't know, I mean, is it formulaic? Yes. You can look at each song, you know, you have the big opening number, You know, now and forever. Da 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 da. You then have you sort of the quasi love song that has a reprieve later by Huey. Like I said, reprieve later by Marina. You have sort of the fun song in The Good Ship of Misery, which I personally like. You have the villain song, which, again, we're going to get into voice cast later. But these are pretty well-known actors to an extent. In this case, the villain, Drake, is played by Tim Curry. It's Tim Curry singing a villain song, Broadway style. What is wrong with you, man? How can you listen to that and be bored? It's Tim Curry singing a villain song. What is wrong with you? How can you be a fan of theater and not enjoy that? Just maybe because the fact that, well, I go listen to it and I get this feeling of it like segueing into him leaving off like I'm a Transylvania transsexual. It all comes back to Rocky Horror Picture Show as well. Wrestling and Rocky Horror Picture Show. That's the two things that keeps coming back to. But that's in order there. But, you know, you got the villain song. You got the buddy song. Is it formulaic? Yes. Is it necessarily generic? No. The reason I say that is to be generic, there has to be no feeling in it. And I know that may seem strange for me to say, it's like, but it's just like the other songs. Yeah, but you could tell Barry Manilow put effort into the music. The songs are catchy. They're fun to listen to. They may, just because they may not be memorable songs that will repeat in your head forever and ever and ever, you know, we can all do a whole new, you know, at any time I feel. I can show you the world, shining, shimmering, splendid. Tell me, princess, now when did you last let your heart decide? I can just break out any time and say that, or look at this stuff, isn't it neat? Wouldn't you say that my collection's complete? Wouldn't you say I'm a girl that has everything? You know, I can just break out into those songs. Yes, they are that memorable that you can just remember them on a dime and all. I know nobody else breaks out in the song. I certainly don't necessarily break out in the song in the middle of nowhere. But, you know, if I'm in the mood and I was thinking to him, like, oh, I love that song. Look, just, you know, I'll maybe start singing it here or there. But, you know, that doesn't mean the songs are bad. When you're watching the movie, the songs are very catchy. They work. They're fun. They're enjoyable. They can't be generic. Generic means there's no feeling in them. Generic means, oh, hey, we need a musical number. Just throw this song in there. There obviously was feeling put into the song. Now, are the songs formulaic? Absolutely. But that is not a bad thing. Just because something is following a formula or is formulaic doesn't make something a bad thing. I think this is a topic I'll be talking a lot through this review. You know, when it comes to following formula, I only ask of two things. If you want to do something different, do something different. Just have it be natural. You know, the best films that follow a formula are those that either do one, like I said, one or two things. They do a slight twist, as to an extent Frozen has, that for the most part feels natural. Again, I'm not going to get into Frozen too much. But for the most part, feels, you know, they put a twist here, a twist there, to make it unique and new and fresh. Or you tell the best story you can to the best of your ability, i.e. Beauty and the Beast. Beauty and the Beast is a very formulaic movie. But what they do is they follow that formula to the best of their ability. They make the characters great. They make the music great. They make everything great, grand, and epic. and it creates this wonderful, wonderful movie. Pebble and the Penguin, as I'll be talking about with story, with animation, and here with music, yes, is it very formulaic? Absolutely. They are following the Disney formula. That is not necessarily a bad thing. What makes it bad are missteps, brushness, and other things that we'll be getting to later in story. But the music itself, albeit some, again, this goes to story, and we'll get to that when we get to story pacing issues that somewhat hurt the songs in the middle. But the music in general is good. It's fun, it's whimsical, it's enjoyable. The musical numbers move the story along. And I just find them very enjoyable. So albeit being formulaic, they're not generic. They're very enjoyable. And they do their part in the story. Now, the overall score, however, is just forgettable. And not that it's necessarily bad, but there really isn't no presence when it comes to the overall score. The score is very light. I wouldn't say there's more than maybe 10 pieces of overall, you know, music outside of the songs when it comes to this movie, as opposed to something like the Disney movies, which might have 25 to 30 pieces beyond the, you know, musical numbers. You know, they'll have sort of instrumental reprieves and single notes here or there, and, you know, this, you know, music's very simple. It doesn't have a really defining presence, and for the most part, I kind of forgot the music was there, so it's really non-existent. So to me, the part of the music we should be focusing on is not being good, is the score, overall score itself, which is, I mean, when you listen to it, it's okay, and it's good, and it works for the film, but it really doesn't have any of a presence, and really doesn't feel like it adds anything to the scene. It's there, it plays the part it's supposed to play, but doesn't have a presence, doesn't enhance anything as a score, as opposed to the song numbers, which are fun and whimsical and move the story along. And last but not least, in regards to the music, as concerns the musical numbers, it is, again, you know, I made mention earlier about how this is very, like Frozen, it's very much to an extent of wanting to be almost a bit too Broadway. And I say that whereas Frozen's need where Frozen is too Broadway in the fact of how some of its songs go, here it's too Broadway in the fact that these musical numbers, as much as I enjoy them, you can really see the set pieces. You know, from, you know, here and then, you know, now and forever, all for her I care, I'll find her the fairest stone. And, you know, they have where you have the group of penguins that are sort of dancing together in perfect choreography. And again, by the way, how very 90s, by the way, both the male and female penguins look. These penguins apparently all go to New York for haircuts. It's hilarious to me. it really is. But that, you know, Huey's Love Song, the setup for that, you know, Drake's villain song, the Good Ship Misery, the Buddy song. You know, you can literally see the Broadway sets watching this movie. I mean, the locations that they're at, and again, this is, I guess, more into art, but really, it deals with music as well. It's just, they pop off more as sets than they do actual locations. And that's a bit of a flawed aspect of it. You know, again, being a bit too Broadway. You know, as opposed to Frozen, which is a bit too Broadway by, you know, how they want to do their songs. You know, and so in that sense of these two films that I think both have the problem of being a bit too Broadway. That's why I like Pebble and the Penguin better, because their songs actually do something. You know, that's the thing that Howard Ashman and Alan Menken and the people that, you know, during Disney's renaissance had when they did Beauty and the Beast, Little Mermaid, Aladdin, Lion King. They understood the power of a song, and they understood when to be Broadway and when not to be. And the fact of the matter is, as Broadway as the musical pieces, you know, take Belle for an example. Belle, yes, Belle is a classic sort of Broadway opening song. But yet when you watch it, there's nothing that screams Broadway. That was the great sort of trick, the illusion, per se, that Disney was able to do, is that they brought Broadway back through the animated process by basically not having it feel Broadway. Yes, you had these show tunes and everything that felt Broadway, but it didn't feel Broadway, because it didn't scream Broadway. You know, here, you know, with Frozen, with Pebble and the Penguin, and other pieces, you know, they're so Broadway that it literally screams Broadway. And you feel more like you're watching a play than a movie. And that can hurt it. So, in regards to that, that is, I think, that is, as far as the music is concerned, that's a bigger, or at least the worst thing it does. Which, in all regards, really isn't that bad, because, you know, as much as I knock on it for it, it still is enjoyable. With that, let's move on to the animation. It's Don Bluth. What do you want me to say? It's Don Bluth, Don Bluth animation. God, I love this man's art style. Again, a lot of it has to do with shadow. He has a wonderful presence of shadow and the use of black. That has a really sort of almost gritty style to it, or a gritness, I should say, that is really fun to look at. And there's art in this movie that is just gorgeous. There's also art, though, however, that is too cartoony and feels rushed. And especially towards the end of the movie. The colors towards the end of the movie meld in a just not in a good way. And just the entire animation, for the most part, towards the back end of the movie, feels rushed. At the front end, there are just some wonderful pieces of art that are just gorgeous. I may mention, by the way, of talking about why I consider this a cartoon. Well, what Don Bluth is doing here is, to an extent, while the backgrounds are beautiful, again, we'll be talking about backgrounds in a little bit, in some more context, but, you know, the backgrounds and that stuff are, to an extent, more sets. While there's a sense of depth to them, it is like they're on a set, or a scene. You know, it's sort of a new way I've been looking at, you know, a difference between a cartoon and an anime is that an anime is more of a sort of movie. Cartoons are sort of more like a play. So there's like a set there, and it's like we're telling the story in front of this set. And while there may be death there, you know you're in a scene as opposed to a area, a space, a world that an anime will do. Here you feel like you're on set pieces. You know, it's what Don Bluth does with Secret of Nim and pretty much all his movies. And so you feel, while there's depth to it and the locations may be interesting and wonderful, you feel like you're on set pieces. You feel like you're watching a play. Oh, and again, that's not necessarily a bad or a good thing. It's just, this is why, to me, this makes Pebble and the Penguin a cartoon rather than an anime. But like I said about the animation overall, I enjoyed it, but I think it was really good towards the beginning and gets rushed at the end, and we'll get into that more. The character designs are just fun. They're very simple. They're very, again, formulaic. I don't think there's anything... Well, they are a bit generic. you know, within the formula. And I'll concede that. But again, it's not like it feels like they just threw it all together. But it is a, well, bit generic, also formulaic, in the sense of, you know, Huey, he's the goofy, shy guy. Let's give him the hat for the guy whose name I'm complete. Okay, I can't even do the joke now because I can't even remember the name. National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, the brother. And all I can think of now is that scene where he's going, "Shitter's full!" That's why I made the joke earlier. To where, you know, he's pumping the sewage. And he's wearing that hat. He's got the boxers, he's got the bathrobe, and he's wearing that goofy little hat. That's what Huey has. So, this movie channeled Christmas, National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation for the goofiness of Huey. You gotta love it. Maria was very pretty, and she had a rose, basically, on her, or a pretty flower on her head, you know, to represent being pretty. You know, Rocco was a rebel. He had a scarf. But if it was a little bit higher, he looked like a gang member. Drake was muscle bound and was Gaston. Why am I even not joking about it? Drake was Gaston. That's what he was. He was the big burly guy who was the best in everything and got everything, but was the bad guy. He literally had a cape. I waited for him to go. One, two, three pebbles, Maria. Ha, ha, ha. You marry me now. It all comes back to Sesame Street. Wrestling, Rocky Horror Picture Show, Sesame Street. It all comes back to it. But I digress. You know, formulaic, a bit generic, but overall I enjoyed it. Albeit a lot of them are somewhat bit goofy. The penguin on the Good Ship Misery that is in the nightgown. Why? Why is there a penguin in a nightgown? It makes no sense. It's goofy. There's the one with the Napoleon hat. Like, why? Why? I don't know. And I don't give a darn. By the way, that's our shortstop. I am a horrible, horrible man. I really am, and I need to be shot. For my crimes against cinema. And I'm sure somewhere Gene and Chris are more than welcome to do it. You know, the action animation and the animation there, like I said, in general, toward the back end it feels rushed, though I really do love the action sequence of the killer whales and the chasing with the killer whales. I think that's done to a point well. I say that because the leap out of the water is great, and most of it is great. When they reuse animation, it's like, okay, you just took us out of the scene. You just reused animation you had 2 seconds ago. You know, it's not anything against reusing animation. But when you use the same clip you just used 2 seconds ago, kind of takes us out of the scene. And the rest of the action, for the most part, is good. And the movement and everything, because to an extent, there's sort of a sense of two aspects of this film. On one hand, this is a romance film of a guy trying to get back to his girl. And at the same time, there's sort of a buddy cop type of, or buddy movie, I should say, going on. To an extent, can kind of compare this to Aladdin. Again, that whole Disney thing that they are trying to cash in on. In the sense of there's a you know, guy likes a girl, and there's a buddy comedy going on at the same time. And so I think the animation that went through both those plot lines did extremely well. And last but not least, we have the backgrounds. Backgrounds, like I said at the beginning, are just absolutely gorgeous. Wonderful. It's obviously a Don Bluth film, but there are pieces here or there in the beginning, you know, on the good ship Misery, to where the line work gets too bold, and it takes you out of the Don Bluth style. And there's, like, I think one of the most infamous ones is the vine that wasn't finished, like, covered, that's hanging in thin air. But especially towards the end, as you know, the colors meld in a not good way, and everything gets dark and everything, and everything gets rushed. I think towards the back end, the backgrounds aren't very good. You know, that ending fight, Drake's lair is supposed to be menacing, yet it's more menacing earlier in the film than it is at the end of the film. And overall, the special effects as well. Again, beginning the film, you know, you had the storm scene, you had all of this stuff, and it's wonderful. The special effects feel almost non-existent towards the back end of this film. And I mean, they are there, but it's like special effects is used sparingly. It's almost as if, with about 20 minutes left, MGM ran out of budget, or at least what they wanted the budget for this film to be. So they rushed everything. And it's really, really obvious. So background special effects both have the same thing. They're, you know, at the beginning of the film, they are gorgeous. The set pieces and everything are just wonderful. And the special effects is on point. The snow, the rain, everything is great. But last 20 minutes, special effects are almost non-existent. And the backgrounds are just meld and don't have the same sort of presence they do as they do in the beginning. And that's not to say that it should. You know, towards the end of the film, there should be a different presence, but it should be a sort of equal presence to something that was at the beginning. It should be different but equal, but here it's different and feels less of something than the presence that the backgrounds and the sort of sets have at the beginning of the movie. Just to go back to action just a little bit, I did like the final fight scene. I thought they did the final fight scene, for the most part, good, up to how it finished. The finish was anticlimactic. The sort of how it went about, I enjoyed. Well, that's it for animation, and it's time for commercials. So I'm going to play some commercials for some friends of mine, and when we come back, we're going to get into acting and into story. After these messages,
hey everyone, my name is Michael Bailey.
And I'm Jeffrey Taylor.
And we host a podcast called From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast.
Presented by the Superman homepage. On the show... Wait.
What?
This just isn't working out for me. It's not bombastic enough. We need something epic.
Like what?
Welcome to From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast, presented by the Superman homepage. I am Jeffrey Taylor.
And I am Michael Bailey.
From Crisis to Crisis chronicles the adventures of Superman.
Wait. I'm just not feeling this.
I'm just wondering how there's a needle scratching sound when all of this is clearly digital.
Look, all we need to say is that this is a trailer for a show called From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast presented by the Superman homepage. My name is Michael Bailey.
I'm Jeffrey Taylor.
And every week we give in-depth synopsis and reviews for just about every Superman book published between Man of Steel number 1 in 1986
and Adventures of Superman number 649 in 2006. We also talk about the related Superman media, what was happening in the rest of the world when these comics were published, and what else was going on in the DC Universe.
The show drops every Thursday-ish at the Superman homepage, which is located at www.supermanhomepage.com.
From Crisis to Crisis is also a proud member of the Superman Podcast Network, located at www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com.
So join Jeffrey and I each week as we explore Superman during the post-crisis era, which includes Exile, Panic in the Sky, Doomsday, The Marriage, and beyond.
And write into the show at FromCrisisToCrisis@gmail.com and hear it read on the air, eventually, because we get behind on that sort of thing.
Superman created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. Side effects from Crisis to Crisis include loss of money from buying back issues, a desire to read 20-year-old comic books, nausea, drowsiness, pizza, blurred vision, upset stomach, a desire to kick puppies and kittens, and backache from lifting boxes of Superman comics. If the excitement of From Crisis to Crisis lasts more than 4 hours, seek immediate medical attention.
Rocketed as a beam from the exploding planet Krypton, Kal-El grew to manhood on Earth, whose yellow sun and lighter gravity gave him fantastic superpowers. In the city of Metropolis, he poses as TV newsman Clark Kent, but battles evil all over Earth and beyond as Superman. Superman in the Bronze Age is a bi-weekly podcast following Superman's adventures from 1970 to 1986. Follow along at supermaninthebronzeage.blogspot.com and superbronze1970.libsyn.com.
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away, a great adventure took place.
I'm going to regret this.
This is ridiculous.
Two freaks!
You stuck up, half-witted, scruffy-looking nerf herder!
Oh no.
Don't be alarmed. It's only a laser sword fight.
Star Tours announces the boarding of the Endor Express, non-stop star speeder service to the moon of Endor. All passengers, please prepare for immediate boarding.
No! Can I get your ship out?
Lando Calrissian is a positive role model in the realm of science fiction fans.
F*** Lando Calrissian.
Star Wars Monthly Mondays, available the first Monday of every month at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com.
We would be honored if you would join us.
And welcome back, and let's get right into it as we always do. And of course, since we're getting into acting, let's go over our cast list, our short cast list. We have Martin Short as Hubie. We have Annie Golden as Marina, James Belushi, brother of the legendary Jim Belushi, as Rocco the Rockhopper, Tim Curry as Drake, and Frank Weckler as the Leopard Seal. So, I guess starting off with our protagonists, I thought Martin Short did a great job. I'm kind of one of those people. I think Martin Short has a hit-or-miss career. And I think there's a lot of people that like him when he's more over-the-top and not subdued. I'm actually one of those people, I think, that likes him more subdued than him over-the-top. Like, Jiminy Glick is probably one of the most famous things that he did over-the-top. I appreciate it it was certainly taking advantage of the whole guy in a fat suit, Eddie Murphy success with the Nutty Professor type of thing. But the whole transforming into a different character, But I was never really a fan of Jimmy. I mean, I appreciate it, and there were times he was funny, but I was never really a fan of the sort of that over-the-topness with Jiminy Glick and the transformations, which Martin Short could be known for. I was always more of a fan of his when he was a bit more subdued. As strange as it may sound, Jungle to Jungle. I just think there are scenes in there where he's just absolutely hilarious, and I liked him more in Jungle to Jungle. They go, "Oh, Jules, and you're not getting..." I just love him with that. I don't know. I know that makes me somehow a horrible person. I don't know why, but it makes me a horrible person. Anyways, but I thought he did a great job in this role. You know, that subdued, you know, he's good with voices. He did a great job with sort of that little stutter. It's almost that classic, you know, every cartoon character has to have that short shy, and as a hero has to have that, like, sort of, you know, vocal disparity. And this guy, the fact that he's, you know, being shy, he stutters a bit, which is understandable. He keeps it throughout the movie, though. I like that they don't constantly have him do it. That's a great choice, not to constantly have Martin Short. I mean, he'll stutter from time to time, but it beginning, it's more prevalent. It's not so prevalent towards the end. Though, goodness, Glacius is just so corny. It really is. And you know what? For the longest time, I always thought he said, "Goodness gracious." I didn't realize until recently he said Glacius. I'm like, what is wrong with these writers? Why would you put that? I know it's for kids, but why? Why? But I thought he did a great job. And also, alongside, I think he had a great sort of repertoire with his fellow actors, his fellow protagonists. You know, because I don't know whether they did it in separate sessions or if they at all did joint sessions, but there seemed to be a great connection with both Martin Short and Annie Golden and Martin Short and Jane Belushi. You know, Annie Golden did a great job as sort of the female protagonist, the nice girl who, you know, is different from the rest because she dares to believe in, you know, personality and in the person rather than the amount of wealth, the pebble. Because it's not like it's really obvious what the whole moral of this story is. But I thought she did a wonderful job. And, you know, I thought that she and Huey in the scenes to her had a great connection. And then, of course, you had James Belushi, which I think it's very unfortunate that James Belushi has been, let's be honest, he's been overshadowed by his brother Jim. Now, I'm in no way saying that James Belushi is necessarily better than Jim Belushi. I'm just saying that I think it's fair that he's overshadowed, because I think he's a very underrated comedian. I pretty much have enjoyed him in most of the stuff he's done. He's had an extensive animated work that, for the most part, I've enjoyed, especially in the 90s. He was very private. I mean, again, you have to understand, this is before sort of voice acting took off as so many people wanting to be in it, like it is now. Because of anime. It's before really Ocean... I mean, Ocean Group was around, but everybody started taking notice of Ocean Group around 2000. And ADV. And Funimation. In 2000. That's when these voice actors really started to come to prominence because of anime. But back in 94 and 93, again, it was, hey, this is MGM, we're in Hollywood. It wasn't so much of, you know, we're getting these actors because we need to put big names on the poster. We're getting these actors because, hey, who's good at doing voice work? Oh, Martin Short is a well-known who's good at doing voice work. So to an extent, it was kind of better than it was, you know, before what we're going through now. Now we have, like, hey, who's a big name we can put on the poster? Eddie Murphy! Mike Myers! And while they may be good in their roles, it's, hey, they're big names to put on a poster, as opposed to back in the day to where it was more, you know, we're in Hollywood, who's good at doing voice work? You know, well, Martin Short is, and Jim Belushi is, and Annie Golden can sing and do that stuff. And, well, who can we play to get to play this leopard seal? I know! Let's get Frank! Frank's good at doing a leopard seal. Plus, he's better than an actual leopard seal. Takes direction better. but yeah, these actors were, you know, prevalent in doing animation, so it wasn't like they just took celebrities. And, you know, James Belushi did a great job here, great job as that sort of rebel who cared. Yes, a very formulaic character, nonetheless, but he did a great job in the role. And, you know, again, being that this was also a bit of a buddy comedy, I thought, again, he had a great connection with Martin Short's character. Or at least the two, again, whether they did in separate sessions or they did together, there seemed to be a great connection between the characters. And that was in part the voice cast. You know, then you have Drake. Tim Curry. How can you have a problem listening to Tim Curry as a villain in an animated film or television? Remember, Tim Curry was initially supposed to be the Joker in Batman the Animated Series. Now, again, I'm not saying he's awful. And though we all are in agreement that thank God that it was given to Mark Hamill. Again, not saying that I don't want to hear him be the Joker. I would love to hear what Tim Curry's take on the Joker would have been. In fact, you get to hear a little, if you have, I think, the first season of Batman the Animated Series, they do showcase a bit of it. But Tim Curry, who does a great job playing villain. Him and Mark Hamill are like the best voice actors to play villains. How can you ever... I've never, ever gotten tired of ever hearing Mark Hamill voice a villain. And I have never, ever, ever gotten tired of listening to Tim Curry play a villain either. Yeah, he just enjoys it, and you can tell he does. And you can tell the feeling coming out. I wish there was more of him being villainous in this film. That being said, he did a wonderful job as Drake. Copying Gaston. Because I've not tired that joke out yet. but I thought he did a great job. And for the most part, the rest of the voice cast, I thought were okay. They weren't spectacular. But again, a lot of focus wasn't put on them, so it didn't feel important. You know, as I think of it, as I think about the rest of the voice cast, I realize something I kind of forgot to talk about with music, more importantly with animation and character designs. It's really evident that this movie was made in the mid-90s, by the way. Because, again, that whole Broadway style, especially that big opening scene to where they're all dancing and everything, take notice to the fact of their hairstyles. The girls and the guys' hairstyles are very 90s. It gives it this very sort of off-Broadway feel, and I wish I would remember to talk about it in animation. That's why I'm going back to it now. But very off, or very Broadway, almost like type of rent, type of play, type of hairstyles. And I just find that funny. But yeah, the back to voice acting and the acting in general. The main cast, I thought, did a great job. The rest of the cast, I thought, was okay, with the exception of Frank Weckler, who was awesome as a leopard seal. He showed such emotion, such range. but I thought the rest of the voice cast did a great job. Let's get into the story. And I guess the main aspect is, really the main plot is Huey and his romance with Marina and him trying to get back to her. And the whole part of the plot that knocks you over the head with it is not the pebble, it's the penguin. A.K.A. Kitties! You shouldn't judge somebody by how much they make. Their wealth isn't as important as their personality. Aw, isn't that cute? Now, I say that, and I like that film. I like this film, I mean. I mean, for the most part, the romance is good. I mean, outside of them knocking you over the head every 20 seconds with the whole moral, you know, overall, I thought the romance between Huey and Marina was good. It's a nice, simple romance, and I like that. I hate that people don't do nice, simple romances anymore. What's wrong with, hey, this guy likes this girl, so this guy who's a rival tries to get rid of him, but he manages to make his way back and get the girl's heart. What's wrong with that? Why is the hope in that? Yes, it's a bit formulaic, but it's not bad. It's not generic. I mean, and that's something I'll say about this film, is that while it is formulaic, it's not generic. And this plot is, while a bit formulaic, is not generic. You know, again, and it also helped because of the sort of great chemistry between Martin Short and Annie Golden, who voiced the characters. As I'll say in the next plot point, between Huey and Rocco, again, Jane Belushi and Martin Short have a great chemistry with their characters. But, you know, again, the romance, again, it's a simple romance, and I think it works. They keep on point, and, again, really, its only crime is that it keeps knocking you over the head every 20 seconds with the whole moral of, well, you know, you shouldn't judge somebody by how their wealth. You should judge them by their personality. You know, or I should say, to add to that, you shouldn't judge somebody by their wealth or their looks. You should judge them by their personality, I should say. Because they do throw in the whole, you know, Drake looks better than Huey. Well, I don't care. But yeah. So for the most part, I thought the romance was, you know, albeit simple, albeit a bit formulaic, but good. And then, of course, you have Huey and Rocco's buddy comedy as they journey back to the Antarctic. Again, simple, albeit a bit formulaic, but it works. And I feel that most of the scenes are genuinely funny. I mean, I can enjoy them. And in fact, for the comedy, though, The Good Ship Misery, like I said, I love that song. I don't know what about that song I love. I just love that song. I love the comedy of it. I love the comedy in that. I love a lot of the little comedic bits throughout the movie. I think Huey and Rocco's comedy repertoire really works. I think of the little fire red ant, the red fire ant, I should say, when they're on the beach. And I don't know why I love this bit so much, but the whole, he sees the emerald and he's trying to get to it so he can steal it, and he's pushing it up the palm tree. Meanwhile, Huey and Rocco are having a discussion. It's like, you know, imagine this. Starboard side. Hey, stars all around. Summarize. And then you hear Rocco going, summarize, summarize, summarize. And that the whole thing of, you know, Huey, he's off in his own little world. And Rocco's like, get to the point. Get to the point. Get to the point. Get. This sounds a whole lot like conversations I have with Gene and Chris. Me off in my own little world, and Gene and Chris like, get to the point, get to the point, get to the point, get to the point. Very odd. I mean, first, Gene, if by any chance you're listening to this, you tell me. They're so gonna hurt me later. But, you know, that whole point, like, and the ant's pushing the emerald up, and they finally get to the point where he shoots across the sky and he throws the ant up. And he's right back where you started. It's like, ah, then to hell with it. and then the whole, it goes back to that song, the whole Bud song. Yeah, I'm trying to remember it. I don't know why those corny jokes make me laugh. I think what it is that they know it's corny, and they just go with it. It's like, okay, here's this joke. What do you call a flower when you open? Huh? What do you call a flower when it opens? A bud. I love it when you call me bud. It's so corny. But they put so much feeling into it, you can't help but chuckle. It's like, okay, these jokes are corny, but I can appreciate them. No, I caught you a herring. Where should I put it? Huh? I caught you a herring. Where should I put it? Put it there. Put it there! All right! I have watched this movie way too much to be quoting. I love sort of the buddy plot because I think, and again, it goes back to the voice acting, but because there's such great chemistry between Martin Short and Gene Belushi, that Huey and Rocco have this sort of great chemistry as characters that I think really works and makes the buddy plot enjoyable and fun. And it keeps you as, again, you have these two plots going side by side. Now that we sort of covered the sort of the good stuff of the plot, let's get into sort of the bad stuff. And that's first off with pacing. Now, I made mention earlier how I was going to talk about pace. And especially in the middle of the movie, the pacing, it's bad. I mean, the movie starts off paced really well. But where it starts to get bad, and it actually settles itself down towards the end of the movie. But there's a point in the movie in the middle where they're going back and forth. They keep going back and forth between, you know, Huey and his story, and back to Marina, and Huey, and then Marina and Drake, and Huey, and then Marina, and back and forth, and it's like, it never gives you any time to get settled with any one scene, and I think that hurts the film overall. Especially with the music. You know, you have the point to where they're with Huey, and then they go back for the second time, and they go back to Drake and Marina, and Drake has his villain song. And then they go back to Rocco and Huey to show a scene that didn't need to be in front of the next scene that would be with Marina, because they show that scene, then they go back to Marina, who does this reprieve of sort of the love song that was done earlier by Huey. And again, the reason I say this is that this movie could have been better if what they would have done is sort of switch that up. After the villain song, have them basically drop Marina back off at... And again, I know this is, would say that MGM would have had to put more thought into this film, and that's probably impossible, but hear me out. What they should have done is, you know, at the end of the villain song, had Marina drop off, and so it goes from the villain song into this little reprieve that I think would have worked better. And then you go back to Huey and Rocco, and you have the scene, and of course, the seal scene that leads up to their buddy. It's a better pacing. You know, you go with Huey, you go from them for a bit, you let the scene settle, you let that build. And then you switch once it's built enough to... I mean, it was okay to have sort of the Drake Marina scene in the Emerald when they are on the ship Misery. But again, you want them to be in a scene long enough for them to have some presence. And that leaves the final part. And the part that I really have been talking about the entire review, and that this movie feels rushed at the end. Really, the final 20 minutes just feels rushed. Not just in the animation, but in story, is that you have this thing to where Rocco was supposedly killed in the killer whale chase. Right. And I say that, that's really the evidence to why it's rushed, is that you see Rocco on the whale tap, there's a splash, then it's back to Huey, and he manages to escape, as, you know, one of the whales tries to eat Michael Jackson, somebody else already did that joke, I'm sorry, I'm an evil person, but no, gets away, and of course, there's like, his scarf, which, by the way, is blue, and then when we see him later, it's green. It's like, okay, then how did you know that was Rocco's scarf? If he has one when we see him the next... I know, I'm asking too much for some continuity at the end of this movie, but I think that's evident to why this movie was rushed. I think you would have that continuity there if it wasn't. But, you know, he's just killed, and there's no drama, there's drama, there's a bit of tension, but not the type of tension you would want for it to believe that a character has died. And then you have the fight, and the fight goes well, but then Rocko appears, and you have the ending of that fight that's anticlimactic, though. I do like the gruesome death that Drake gets. Squashed like a bug. Which leads to the awkward flying, but of course that also leads to the awkward flying scene. That again, it has tension, it has a bit of drama, but doesn't have sort of the amount of tension you would want for the triumph of Rocko flying. And it just, everything from there feels rushed. Like, oh my god, we only have 5 minutes to tell this entire fight scene and the end of the movie and to show them in Christmas hats to, you know, cash in on it being a Christmas movie. We need to rush this along. It just feels rushed. And I think it really hurts the movie. To me, that's a worse offense than being formulaic. I don't have a problem with a movie being formulaic. Because again, you can be a formulaic movie and really not do anything different. But if you do a solid movie and do the best of your ability and you don't rush and you have great pace and you tell a great story, there's nothing wrong with it being a formulaic story. I mean, I guess maybe I'm one of those few people who thinks that way. But here, when you see a movie being rushed like this does, it takes all the tension out, it takes all the drama out, and it really hurts the movie. And that's where I think the bigger crime of this movie is. And what makes this movie, I'm not going to say it's not good, but not great. It's obvious, like, this is where the movie comes a bit generic, in a term. So, yeah, the last 20 minutes, both in story and animation, everything is just like, oh, we need to get to the end. We got 5-10 minutes to do it. We need to rush. Let's go. And the fight scene feels short than it is. The whole tension of them falling feels short. The orca chase feels short. You know, this movie could have, you know, I think, benefited from having about 10 more minutes at the least. So, at the end of the day, what's my final thought about this movie? You know, I think we have to keep in mind that this is a kids' movie. This is what this was. This wasn't a movie made for everyone, like the Disney movies are. You know, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, Lion King, Hunchback of Notre Dame, Little Mermaid, all these movies are made for everyone. I mean, there's stuff in there, so it can be a kids' movie, and kids can enjoy it. But there's also stuff in there for adults, that adults can appreciate. There's adult jokes. There's behind this, you know, there's stuff behind the curtain, per se, that we can enjoy. This was a movie made for kids. It was trying to cash in on the romantic thing, but be just for kids. And I don't fault it for being that. That being said, it is a formulaic movie, and it is rushed at the end, and that hurts the movie, but at the end of the day, I still find it enjoyable to watch. I do get enjoyment out of watching it. I don't feel like I've had 100 minutes taken from my life. The songs are enjoyable and catchy. The animation, particularly at the beginning, is wonderful. The voice acting is really good. I mean, it's Tim Curry at his as a villain. It's James Belushi and Martin Short having a great repertoire. Overall works. It's just, again, it's what hurts this film is that last 20 minutes. It feels rushed. It's obvious it's rushed. And it gives it the perception of being generic, when really, its worst crime, if anything, is that it's a bit formulaic. And when I say a bit formulaic, I mean it is formulaic. But again, like I've said over and over and over as I continue to beat this dead horse, it's not being formulaic that the problem. It's not putting any feeling. It's not putting any effort. It's not putting anything into it other than, hey, let's just throw these characters in together and make a movie. I didn't get that feeling from this movie. Don Bluth put feeling into this movie. Barry Manilow put feeling into the music of this movie. Martin Short, Gene Belushi, Annie Golden, Tim Drake put feeling into their acting. There are people that cared about this movie and did great work on this movie. Again, it's that back 20-minute part of the film where they feel like they rushed everything. And, you know, you can't fault them completely for that. So at the end of the day, I give A Pebble and the Penguin a 3 out of 5. It's a good movie. It's an enjoyable movie, I should say. It can be considered good, especially if you're watching the first half of it, but it's extremely rushed at the end. So, 3 out of 5 from me. So, that is it for my review of The Pebble and the Penguin. Remember, if you have any comments of any kind that you want to let me know about why I'm completely wrong about my opinion, which I'm sure a lot of you want to do, I welcome any opinion. Any and all opinions are welcome. Remember, there are several ways you can contact the show. One, you can contact the show by email at absolutionnetwork132@gmail.com. That's absolutionnetwork132@gmail.com. You can also contact the show or leave us a message by joining our Facebook page, going to www.facebook.com. Search for the Absolution Network. We're the one with the logo that has a circle and an A and an N in it. And like us and leave us a comment there. And of course, you can always leave a comment on the website itself, which you can find at www.an.132productions.com. Of course, remember to check out all our other 132 Productions content. That, of course, includes the Otaku Momentum right here on the Absolution Network. Gene and Chris's The Shaft Plus podcast that you can find at www.shaftplus.com. And of course, my other podcasting venues, the Tokyo SOS podcast, a Godzilla podcast that you can find at www.tokyosos.132productions.com. And of course, my Comic Book Crazy podcasting network that features Comic Book Crazy and Hexcast. You can find that at www.comicbookcrazy.132productions.com. And, of course, while you're there, check out our sidebar. Check out all our friends on the sidebar of the site that you can find who do great work. That, of course, includes Michael Bailey and Fuse Malombox. And From Crisis to Crisis that he does with Jeffrey Taylor. Brad Douglas's Spider-Man Crawl Space, Steven Seiker's Major Spoilers Podcast, and of course Scott Gardner's Two Freaks Podcast Network, among many more. So that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. Next week, we're getting closer to Christmas, so it's time for another holiday movie. And next week, nope, we're gonna get loony, as in Looney Tunes, as we review Bah Humbug, a Daffy Duck Christmas Carol. Yes, that one. This is gonna be fun. So until next time, my Toonami generation.
Find cover. It's gonna get too dangerous.
Stay golden.
about does her. Hope you enjoyed it. This is Tom, signing off. And until we meet again, you know the rest.